From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
I'm Madeline Brand. 4 years ago, President Bush declared success in Iraq as he stood on the deck of a Navy aircraft carrier. Above his head hung a banner that read, "Mission Accomplished." Later in the program, we'll check in at the White House and in Baghdad.
But first, today, we begin a new series called Climate Connections. Over the next year, NPR is going to team up with National Geographic and travel the world to look at how climate changes people and how people change climate. Madeline, when we began planning this series and you said, "I'm going to go to Hawaii," I thought, she'll never get away with that.
But I did. And it's actually, Hawaii is actually the birthplace. You wouldn't know it. It's the birthplace of global warming science in a way. It's where a man named Charles David Keeling went to the Mauna Loa volcano, that's on the Big Island, 11,000 feet up, to sample the world's purest air. He first went there, well, some 50 years ago in 1958, and then he plotted his data on a graph.
And this is the graph that became what's called the Keeling curve. This is such a big part of the famous Al Gore documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. And I think Al Gore said it's this image that actually got him started on this.
That's right. The Keeling curve, what it does is it shows a continuous rise in carbon dioxide emissions in the Earth's atmosphere.
Caused by us burning fossil fuels.
There is another such assumption that a lot of people have in their minds right now about global warming that just ain't so. The assumption is something like this. The Earth is so big, we can't possibly have any lasting harmful impact on the Earth's environment. And maybe that was true at one time, but it's not anymore.
Charles David Keeling's research made global warming a fact, not just a theory. And so the Keeling curve is now considered one of the most important discoveries of the 20th century. This is his longtime colleague, scientist Richard Somerville.
Together with iconic figures like the helical structure of DNA or picture of Darwin's finches, it is the hard data that every subsequent piece of research acknowledges, either tacitly or explicitly.
Well, Madeline, this is now accepted science, but when you're talking about Charles Keeling starting this work back in the 1950s, I mean, who thought there even was such a thing as global warming then?
Not many people. You know, it was fringe science back then. But Keeling, in his 20s, he knew he was onto something. And Alex, for the rest of his life, Charles Keeling ate, slept, and breathed carbon dioxide. He wouldn't realize until a lot later the larger significance of his work. It all rests on this tiny sound. That's the sound of air rushing into a glass flask. Keeling designed that flask. It's the size and shape of a bowling ball. He'd hold it into the wind and close it off. Inside, nothing but air. And then he'd analyze that important nothingness back at the lab to find out how much CO2 was in there. Keeling would go out to gather the wind anytime he could. Even on weekends, he'd bring along his young bride, Louise.
We went around collecting air samples, various places when we were first married, camping out.
You did it together?
Yes, we did it together.
Together, Louise and Dave, she called him by his middle name, would go on these cheap vacations, but they were really science trips.
When we went to, we had a summer home in Montana, and even there, Dave would take air samples. I have a picture of him in his PJs going up the hill behind our place in Montana with a rucksack and the flasks, alarm clock, and his tent. We were camping in a very dense area, and he was taking air samples during the night every 3 hours, and he had a notebook. And in the middle of the night, and we heard this noise, and my husband turned the flashlight on, and the deer was walking away with the notebook in his mouth. So Dave just hollered, and it was a buck, ran off, and luckily dropped the notebook. And we have it. We still have that. I think it has teeth marks in it.
Those chewed on notebooks were among the many, many, many notebooks Keeling filled with columns of numbers.
He didn't know what he was going to find. I think that's quite clear. No one really knew that there was going to be this simple, beautiful record that emerged.
Ralph Keeling is also a scientist. He's carrying on his dad's work.
I think he had a sense that people were going to look back on this and say, wow, these are great records and someone needs to do this. So he was playing for us right now, in a sense.
Well, he is playing for us right now. That's Charles Keeling on a home recording.
I didn't know anything about his science, but I knew he was a great musician.
Louise was just 19 years old when she met Dave at a concert he gave at a neighbor's house. She says he could have been anything, a lawyer, an astronomer. He almost became a professional pianist. This is not a man who did things halfway.
His outlet was he would sit at the piano and play for hours. I used to want to open the windows and the doors so all the neighbors would hear him play because he was very good.
He had a drive for perfection in piano and in science. When he was just 27 years old, he challenged his boss, Roger Revelle, a world-renowned climate scientist, about how to take carbon dioxide measurements. Revelle wanted Keeling to measure carbon dioxide the traditional way, and that meant taking air samples around the world, sort of like taking a public opinion poll of the air, and take that poll, say, every 10 years to see how much the CO2 had increased. No, 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 said Keeling. You don't need to go all over the world because the air will come to you. Better to measure in one place, one clean place, and measure every day. In 1958, Keeling set up his CO2 measuring station in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on a dormant volcano, Mauna Loa, Hawaii. You have to drive up a twisty road among red and black volcano. It's what I imagine Mars looks like. And when I get there, wow, I can feel what Keeling must have felt. The clouds are below me.
The air is quite thin up here, and everyone who comes up here feels a little woozy and has to get their mountain legs or their volcano legs. The air is just so clean feeling, so crisp.
A few scientists work here at Mauna Loa. One of them is Steve Ryan. He takes measurements once a week exactly the same way Keeling did when he set it all up 50 years ago.
And now Steve's going to take a measurement. A CO2 measurement.
I
measurement
have one of the original Keeling flasks. I'm going to open it up and take an air sample, and the air will rush inside and fill it up, but I have to be careful not to contaminate it with my own breath. And then I'm going to hold my breath, walk into the wind, and you'll hear the sound of the flask opening. Here we go. There it is. We've exposed a flask.
I can't help being amazed by how low-tech it all is. The 50-year-old flask held up to the wind, then sent by regular U.S. mail back to the mainland to be analyzed. That happens once a week. Every 10 minutes, a mechanical analyzer takes air samples inside a cinder block building on Mauna Loa. It spits out graph paper with frenetic lines on it. For years, the lines would be measured by hand, just as Keeling commanded. He insisted that his measurements be carried out exactly the same way for decades. Only last year, after his death, did the scientists feel free to switch to a computer. John Chin took the handmade measurements for 40 years with a calculator, pencil, and ruler.
Is that a ruler?
Yep. That's an air sample trace.
I just did a calculation. If Johnny did this for 20 years, and every 10 minutes you had to...
Every 10 minutes,
that comes a little over 1 million data points in 20 years by hand.
Amazing, isn't it?
1 million data points? Why, oh why, so much data? Was it necessary? I mean, after all, Keeling had proved his point several times over. Carbon dioxide was increasing. It had been for decades. Here's his son, Ralph.
I think there was a sense, okay, well, you did this problem. You saw this problem's done. Why don't you move on to something else? And he was saying, no, I mean, we need to keep this going. This is important.
Keeling had to constantly fight to keep his Mauna Loa station running. Science funding tends to go with the new, not the 50-year-old measurements. The people with money in Washington wanted to know, where were the discoveries? Where were the exciting breakthroughs? The answer was right in front of them, right there on that line, the Keeling curve. At Mauna Loa, the curve is blown up on the wall. I look closely, and Steve Ryan, the scientist there, says in every dip and spike, you can see what has happened in the world over the last 50 years.
What was this?
Yeah, and then if you look at this average line, it kind of flattened out here, and that was after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So the former Soviet Empire, the economy kind of slackened off for a couple of years.
Once you hit 2000... that's a steep increase.
Yeah, well, now there's the China and India becoming more into first world nations.
Becoming
fossil fuel usage is increasing.
Back in California, at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, Ralph Keeling now continues plotting the Keeling curve his father began a half century ago.
You can look at it as a beautiful scientific record, or you can look at it as an alarm bell.
That record is responsible for our current understanding that global warming is indeed happening and that humans are causing most of it.
It took a while to get to the point of actually realizing that this was an alarm bell.
And how did your dad look at it?
I'm not sure. I think he was proud of it as a scientific achievement. So probably initially as a beautiful record.
Charles Keeling died in 2005 at his home in Montana, where he'd go to relax. But even then, it was late spring. He couldn't resist hiking into the wilderness with his tent, his notebook, and his flasks to find out what the wind was saying.
And you can see the Keeling curve and a slideshow from the Mauna Loa volcano at our website. It's npr.org/climate. And for that report, thanks also to producer Deb Clark and editor Martha Little.